Next case is In Re Congolium Corporation, number 23-1295. Whenever council's ready, you can start. Take your time.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Please, the court. Ian Gershengorn on behalf of BAP Ironworks here. I'd like to reserve, with the court's permission, 4 minutes for rebuttal.
That'll be granted.
The core of this dispute is an unambiguous provision of the confirmation order in Congolium's 2010 bankruptcy that BAP Ironworks has no responsibilities for any of the liabilities of the Congolium flooring business. That provision was an essential part of the settlement and sale order that allowed Congolium to sell back its insurance policies, bringing hundreds of millions of dollars into the bankruptcy estate while eliminating more than $900 million in potential insurance coverage for BAP. As Judge Kaplan properly found below, Occidental was a creditor in the Congolium bankruptcy with notice of the settlement and sale agreement, the plan's disclosure statement, and the confirmation order, and Occidental is thus bound. Occidental and the district court offer three main arguments for why Judge Kaplan erred in reaching that conclusion. First, they claimed he abused his discretion by reopening the bankruptcy case rather than leaving the matter for Judge Arleo to decide. But Judge Kaplan had recently interpreted.
Well, can we talk about that a little bit? Because this wasn't really brief, but I'm curious about your position on this. It seems that the parties and Judge Kaplan and I guess Judge Arleo as well discussed our Zinchiak case and other cases dealing with sort of who's best suited. But is that really applicable here? Because those cases dealt with competing state court matters. Isn't this a matter of who, you know, was this referred to the bankruptcy court? Was it not? It seems to me that the original bankruptcy, after Judge Pisano decided it, was referred back, and it was never withdrawn. So doesn't that mean that the bankruptcy judge had the authority to decide it?
So we think
the reference was not withdrawn, right?
The reference had initially been withdrawn, but you're absolutely right, Your Honor. Judge Pisano had referred it back. This is at A-1972 in the record.
Right.
He had referred it back to the bankruptcy court for case administration and such other proceedings as may become necessary. And so we do think this is a situation in which Judge Kaplan properly received the motion to interpret and clarify the sale order and the confirmation order. And, you know, to the extent that, you know, that Judge Arleo or the others on the other side think that there was a problem with that, we really do think it is misplaced, that the court has said, and the Supreme Court said in Travelers, and this court has said over and over, as Your Honor said, in Zinchiak and Lazy Days and Esther Steele, that the bankruptcy court is the natural court to interpret and enforce its own order.
But what is, what is the enforcement of the order? Let's go back for a second, because I want to understand, what is your definition of four other cause in 350B?
So we think that in this case, for other cause means to interpret or enforce a prior order of the bankruptcy court. We think there are at least two here, the confirmation order and the century sale order, and that both of those, that constitutes cause. And indeed, that's...
How would the resolution of the motion here impact the administration of the bankruptcy estate?
Your Honor, it would not impact the administration of the bankruptcy estate, but that is not the test.
Well, why is it not the test? I mean, that's what that was present in both Zinchiak and Lazy Days.
So, Your Honor, it was not present, for example, in the Supreme Court's decision, which of course binds this court in Travelers. That was a situation in which Travelers, of course, was an insurance company that had put in money into the estate, and that the claimants there were asbestos private plaintiffs. And what the Supreme Court said was, of course, the court has jurisdiction to interpret its order. I mean, of course, this court said exactly the same thing. admittedly in unpublished decisions in both Land Source and TE Hold Corp. And so it really has to be that way, Your Honor. The test can't be, does it impact the estate? Because the bankruptcy court all the time issues, decides things like sale orders and things that affect non-debtors. And so it's critical that in order to enforce the orders of the bankruptcy court, that the bankruptcy court be able to adjudicate disputes between two non-creditors. And again, that happens over...
Well, I understand the distinction between jurisdiction and core and non-core, but I'm still back to thinking, isn't this an interpretation of 350B? Don't we need to say, so you've said that it doesn't, the best reading of 350B doesn't include things that would impact the administration of the bankruptcy estate. So then what is the standard that we're looking to here, and what are the boundaries of how it gets to be applied?
So I'd like to make 2 points on 350B in particular, Honor, that like focusing on the estate or the debtor is really a mistake there, because 350B, one of the prongs is to accord relief to the debtor. And that says, or for other cause. So it would be very odd to limit or for other cause to things that affect the debtor as a matter of statutory construction. But then again,
what is it, if anything?
It's a broad provision that said for other cause. We think at the core of it, or at least one core piece of it, is to interpret or enforce the bankruptcy court's own orders, and particularly the confirmation order. That really is the core of the plan. And it really has to be that way. If you think about what the bankruptcy court is doing all the time, it's re-adjudicating and changing the legal rights of the parties. And if an entity in the position of Bath Ironworks can't rely on the bankruptcy court's protections, for example, in a sale or in Travelers, the protection that was granted to the insurance companies there, then the bankruptcy system really falls apart. And I think Judge Kaplan recognized that. He said, like, if we go down this road, there's going to be an asterisk on all settlements. So I think at the core,
well, why would the Article 3 judge competent to make that determination? I guess what I'm still struggling with is it's not as if this issue wouldn't have been decided. It simply would have been decided by the Article 3 court.
So, Your Honor, it certainly could have, but I have a couple of points on that. One, I mean, this court...
Well, I would actually, let me just push back on that. It has to be unless you fall within 350B. Would you agree with that?
I do think that's right, Your Honor. It has to be reopened in that case. But this court has addressed subject matter jurisdiction, which is what Your Honor is presumably getting at, and within 350B, over and over and over again, right? That's Esser Steele, that's Allegheny, that's Lazy Days. Like, these are cases in which the bankruptcy court is reopening cases in order to interpret its prior orders. And indeed, although this is under 350B and reopening, I mean, I think it is worth noting, as Judge Kaplan did, that the actual reopening is kind of a ministerial task, and that the real question is, are you providing the substantive relief that's appropriate? And again, I think when you're getting into interpreting and enforcing a prior order of the bankruptcy court, that again is about allocating the rights and responsibilities of non-debtors, that the court has to be able to do that in order to protect its jurisdiction, because parties won't settle the cases. They won't, for example, pour in the insurance funds into the estate, as happened in Travelers, as happened in this case. And companies, by the same token, such as DIW, as Bath Ironworks, can't rely on the bankruptcy court's actions in giving up its rights under the policy, and it really causes the bankruptcy code to grind to a halt. If I could hit the other 2 points that I'd like to just touch on, because I think they're essential for understanding what Judge Kaplan did. Although Occidental portrays itself as just a pre-petition vendor, what Judge Kaplan found was that it was a core creditor in the bankruptcy. Occidental had known for years that it had litigation exposure to the contaminations of Passaic River, and companies that had agreed to indemnify Occidental had appeared in the bankruptcy, filed claims, and in fact filed claims on Occidental's behalf. So Occidental was a creditor in the core sense that's relevant here. And third, Occidental had the sufficient notice. Judge Kaplan carefully reviewed both the documents that Occidental admits it receives and the documents that Occidental disputes it receives, and he found that adequate notice had been given, particularly given that Occidental was a sophisticated company with a significant known environmental claim represented by able counsel.
Now, but your adversary points out an interesting policy argument that if they're required to spend money, or any creditor is required to spend money and sift through and try to discern what's going on and whether that might affect them sometime in the future, won't that result in exorbitant costs, and is that really fair?
So, Your Honor, a couple of points on that. We really don't think that's right. Actually, we think if you go down that path, like Kennedy, that way madness lies. The point of this is a sophisticated company with a known environmental claim that hired Able Bankruptcy Counsel for precisely this reason. What Judge Kaplan, an experienced bankruptcy judge, found was the 7 pages of disclosures would at least have put a sophisticated counsel on notice that you need to look at those provisions. What the other side's argument basically amounts to is, well, we don't have to look at documents because they're really big. But that's exactly why they've hired experienced counsel. Now, you're talking about, again, a company with a significant environmental claim. It is then told, as Judge Kaplan found, that there were disclosures that affect both asbestos and non-asbestos claims. And their position then, that our lawyers don't have to read the documents, I think is really quite troubling. And again, it goes to this core question of what are we expected how are we expected to have resolutions in the bankruptcy court, have lasting staying power, and be in a situation that companies can rely on those determinations in giving up substantial rights. Remember, we gave up $900 million in insurance coverage, right? The insurance companies poured $230 million into the estate. Those things are done on the background assumption that parties with notice are bound. And the Supreme Court really, I think critically, couldn't be more clear on that. You know, and this court, too, if you think about what this court said in Penn Central Transportation, that was a situation in which the client didn't even know it had a claim. And this court said, because you had notice, because you were a creditor, you are bound and you lose that claim. And so we think to go down the road of, gosh, that was a really big document in a situation with a known massive environmental claim and Able counsel really is not sustainable. The other argument, to be clear on this point, is what Judge Kaplan found is that it was more likely than not that they actually had gotten notice of the Century sale motion itself, although he said it couldn't be conclusive. He said the scales tipped that way. Even Occidental doesn't argue that that would not have been sufficient notice.
Okay. All right. Well, you've got some substantial time left, so we'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
And may it please the Court, Erin Murphy on behalf of Occidental Chemical Corporation. The Bankruptcy Court radically abused any discretion it may have had when it reopened this decade-old bankruptcy proceeding so it could interpret a finding that was made not by the Bankruptcy Court, but by the District Court, and was never even reduced to a Section 105 injunction or any other type of coercive order capable of enforcement. To be sure, bankruptcy courts do have some discretion to reopen bankruptcy proceedings when necessary to interpret and enforce their own orders, although even then there are caveats and principles that they should apply, taking into account factors like delay. But by the bankruptcy court—
But going back to first principles, I mean, when the district court refers something, as the standing order does, to the bankruptcy court can act, right?
Well, the proceeding is closed, so the bankruptcy court can act only to the extent the bankruptcy court has jurisdiction to reopen the bankruptcy. And when the question is how to interpret a finding that the bankruptcy court itself didn't issue, that's just, I mean, I haven't seen any case where a bankruptcy court reopens the proceeding so they can decide what a district court meant when a district court entered a confirmation order. And this
unusual. I mean, there's not that many district courts that get that involved.
It is. It's extremely unusual, and that's what makes this such a kind of an odd case for a bankruptcy court to reopen.
Right.
Because it's rare that you have what Judge Pisano did here in withdrawing the reference and presiding over the confirmation process himself. But once you have that, and Chief Judge Kaplan himself said here with the operative order is the order that was issued by the district court, the entire justification, I mean, one of the two principal justifications for the bankruptcy court reopening is gone. Because if you look at the cases, what they're talking about is that the judge who issued the order has unique insight into what the order means. But Judge Kaplan has no more unique insight into this than Judge Arleo or Judge McNulty in the DVL proceedings, because he didn't issue this. He didn't even preside over the bankruptcy proceedings before the reference was withdrawn or later. I mean, that's another really unusual.
As you correctly point out, this is an entirely new set of judges. But you're saying that the district court in the first instance is the only one that could really have made this call, you know, application of a prior district court order?
Well, the district court unquestionably has jurisdiction and the power to do this. In the ordinary court,
they'd have to withdraw the reference, though, wouldn't they?
No, not at all. Of course not. This was an issue that arose in the context of just regular litigation. We sued BIW in litigation where we moved.
Well, how about reopening the bankruptcy? Isn't that something that the bankruptcy judge has the authority to do?
Only consistent with the statute and the principles that this court has identified that limit that authority. And one of those, to get to the question of kind of what is within the scope of the power to reopen, the other thing that's missing here is in Travelers and all of these cases, what you have is the bankruptcy court is interpreting a coercive order. Somebody has brought a second set of litigation that is alleged to violate a discharge order or violate a Section 105 injunction. And we don't have that here because BIW, for all it claims that it was, you know, all about adequate protection and it was front and center in this bankruptcy, it didn't even participate in the first Congolian bankruptcy, let alone ever go in and ask for adequate protection or a release or a Section 105 injunction. So there is no order, there's no injunction, there's nothing in the section in the original bankruptcy that is some sort of order coercive in the sense of a 105 injunction or a discharge that you could say was, there's no argument that it was violating a bankruptcy court order. Their argument is essentially an issue preclusion argument. They think a finding was made in the course of confirming this bankruptcy that ought to have preclusive effect in the current proceedings and that are separately going on between Occidental and BIW before Judge Arleo. And I mean, in the ordinary course, issue preclusion that's always decided by the court before whom it's raised. You don't go back to the judge that issued the finding and say, you know, what was the meaning of that and does it have preclusive effect? So here, you know, there is an exception generally in the bankruptcy context, but really that exception is limited to two things that are not present here. One, you need to have some sort of order that's being enforced, not just a finding that was made somewhere in the course of a bankruptcy proceeding that has no coercive effect and was never reduced to any kind of order. And two, you ought to have the judge who made the finding. And here, while it's certainly true, you know, Judge Pisano, who had issued the confirmation order, had passed, Judge Ferguson, who was the bankruptcy judge who presided over the Congolian bankruptcy, she was still on the bench when this motion to reopen came in. And nonetheless, Chief Judge Kaplan decided to reassign the case to himself and said, I think I'm better positioned than the bankruptcy judge who actually presided over the bankruptcy.
Well, are you saying that's an abuse of discretion?
I think it's all an abuse of discretion for him to have reopened these proceedings at all. And when you take kind of the fact it's a district court order that he's interpreting, and he's not the bankruptcy judge who was involved in the original bankruptcy proceedings, it's just an extraordinarily unusual set of circumstances for an Article I tribunal to say, I'm going to essentially wrest jurisdiction away from a district court that has pending before it the very question that I'm now going to say I'm going to resolve in the first instance instead, especially when that Article I tribunal is acting underneath the Article III judge, the district court here before whom these issues are pending.
And then unusual that the Article III tribunal would have to defer to the Article III court would have to defer to the findings of the Article I court, particularly as it relates to something like statutory interpretation.
That's exactly right. And it just becomes, you know, I mean, that's ultimately what this comes down to is, you know, by going to the bankruptcy court first, that enables them to try and claim some sort of deference to findings and determinations that were made by the bankruptcy court, and the bankruptcy court just never should have been making those in the first place. And I would like to note that even if you set aside kind of those two, what I think are kind of irreducible minimums of what you need for reopening the same judge and a coercive order, one of the key factors that is taken into consideration in motions to reopen is delay. And set to the side for the moment that we're talking about a decade-old bankruptcy, we have a massive delay here, even in the course of this dispute that's arisen, because BIW was first sued by Congolians In 2017, on the theory that BIW, not Congolium, has liability for all of these environmental issues, and then we sued BIW in 2018 on the theory that BIW, not Congolium, has all of these liabilities. Both of those cases were brought in district court, and BIW did not respond to either by saying, oh, we need to go to the bankruptcy court and ask the bankruptcy court to reopen the 2010 bankruptcy proceedings. It instead proceeded as on the agreement that the right judge to resolve those issues was the district court. In fact, as Chief Judge Kaplan notes in his order in this proceeding, BIW resisted when the issue first went before the bankruptcy court, which happened because there was an adversary proceeding in the course of Congolium's second bankruptcy. BIW didn't want the bankruptcy court resolving this. They said we should be in district court. It was only 4 years into litigation with DBL and 3 years into litigation with Occidental, they received a favorable ruling from Chief Judge Kaplan in the context of this adversary proceeding in the second Congolium bankruptcy. And all of a sudden, you know, lo and behold, they decided, oh, this should have been a motion to reopen. This all should have been before the bankruptcy court.
What was that favorable ruling?
The favorable ruling was, so in the course of the second Congolium bankruptcy, BIW and Congolium litigated between themselves the question of what the meaning of this finding is. Now, I would note, by the time Chief Judge Kaplan is resolving that question, there's actually not adversity as between BIW and Congolium. They have come to an agreement among themselves.
What was the agreement?
They think that they both decided the finding means what BIW says it means. And they actually went to Chief Judge Kaplan with a settlement agreement and said, hey, would you enter all of these findings and declare them preclusive for purposes of litigation against companies like Occidental?
But wouldn't it be correct to say that BIW has no responsibility for the liabilities of the flooring business?
Yeah, I don't actually. So really, you know, as happens when you've got a judge who wasn't familiar with the proceedings, we do not think that he got it right about this finding at all. I think in context, all this finding that was happening back then was doing is resolving that question of liability as between Congolium and BIW, in the sense that Congolium had agreed to indemnify BIW for any past liabilities. And in fact, if you go look at the proceedings,
what was the finding that BIW had no responsibility for the flooring?
But they have no responsibility in the sense that they don't have responsibility as to Congolium because Congolium agreed to indemnify them and to defend them. And that's actually, so when we sued BIW in our in the CERCLA action, BIW filed a third-party complaint against Congolium. And BIW, in that third-party complaint, they didn't raise all this bankruptcy court stuff. They didn't say, you know, this is all about estoppel or preclusion or any of that. Their argument was that Congolium had breached a 1986 contract under which, when there was a restructuring of all these companies, Congolium agreed to indemnify and defend BIW in any future litigation. Now, that may well be true.
Is that because Congolium felt that BIW was not necessarily involved, or?
You know, there was a restructuring of all these companies in the 80s, and the real underlying dispute here about who actually has liability all arises out of that restructuring. There was like an earlier version of Congolium known as 1984 Congolium. Its assets and liabilities were sold were kind of put in one company. But the Congolium, 1984 Congolium entity was merged into BIW. And so there's basically a dispute between the parties, and there used to be a dispute between BIW and Congolium about which parts of 1984 Congolium went with which company.
Would it be fair to say that BIW does not have any liability?
I mean, BIW believes it has no liability, but our view is BIW, as a legal matter, has the CERCLA liability. Maybe they did reach an agreement with Congolium that Congolium has to indemnify them.
Just one last question. Could you be more specific about what liability BIW has?
Sure. This is all about the separate CERCLA action. We sued them as a potentially responsible.
It seems like it's a totally separate business from the others.
Well, when BIW was sold off, this original Congolium 1984, part of it was merged into BIW. And so the dispute is the part, you know, the company, that 1984 Congolium that was merged into BIW before it was sold off, what came with that? And if what came with that was liabilities of BIW, of 1984 Congolium, then BIW is the liable party.
So you would say BIW is still on the hook?
Yes, I mean, we have sued them in our CERCLA action, and we maintain that they are the potentially responsible party. It may well be that they have an indemnification agreement with Congoleum, and we think all the finding that was all the finding here was ever doing was saying that they, as between themselves, Congoleum had agreed to indemnify, so as between themselves, you know, there's not responsibility on BIW's part. And frankly, I really think that has to be what the finding means, because otherwise, I mean, on their reading, you have the bankruptcy court resolving a question of liability about claims between two sets of non-debtors that are neither of whom are participating in the bankruptcy. Because again,
well, can we go back to that? Because you said the two irreducible minimums are the same judge in a coercive order. Where does that come from?
You know, I, for me, it comes in that I can't, like, find any case that doesn't involve both of those things.
Well,
I mean, right,
and I'd also think that, to your point about the effect on the bankrupt state, it seems that when you look at where 350B, you know, 350B came from, going back to the 1800s Act and then the 1970 rule and the 1938 Amendment, it's always talking about impact to the estate. It's always talking about hidden assets, creditors that weren't known, something that goes to the function of the bankruptcy tribunal. So is that something we should be thinking about?
I think that's right. I will agree with my friend on the other side that, you know, I don't think the Travelers case, for instance, obviously did involve third party liability, not the debtor's liability. But what makes Travelers and all the other cases fundamentally different is they all involve the Section 105 injunction. And so the argument was the bankruptcy court issued an order that this second proceeding violates. You should be like being held in contempt for violating the injunction. And then in Travelers, as often happens in these cases, there was a dispute about what actually was the scope of the 105 injunction. And so you say the bankruptcy court who issued it is best positioned to answer that question. But here, when you're talking about, I mean, for all BIW has this story to tell now, BIW never asked for any adequate protection, and that's quite notable because they're now claiming to have lost insurance rights under dozens and dozens of policies, yet there's no finding in any of the other sales. They never participated. They weren't a negotiator at the table. They weren't asking for any of this. And in fact, if you go look at the proceedings, what was actually being represented by Congoleum in the context of these sales was that BIW and these other entities listed in that finding didn't have rights under these insurance policies.
You've complained a bit about the bankruptcy court basically usurping some authority here, but didn't Judge McNulty basically defer to the bankruptcy court? I mean, he may have not have said that, but they didn't decide the motion, right?
Well, Judge McNulty actually denied a motion to dismiss, agreeing that these claims should go forward, and then the parties came back with a settlement agreement to Judge McNulty and said, we've resolved our dispute, and that was the end of the proceedings in the DVL case. And in our case, we never got to Judge Arleo because the magistrate judge said we didn't like kind of have the right notice or whatever it was for purposes of filing our motion, which Judge Arleo has now said was an abuse of the magistrate's judge discretion in not hearing our summary judgment motion on all of this. So we think the right, I mean, of course, BIW gets to litigate all this. We just think they should litigate it as would normally happen in the district court proceedings where we sued BIW and there's an Article III judge perfectly capable of resolving all of these questions.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. They sued the court. I have 5 points this morning, so I'm going to cover a lot. First, this, with respect to the reopening, this is an abuse of discretion standard. So the question is whether Judge Kaplan abused his discretion when. Judge Pisano, who did decide the initial order, referred it back to the bankruptcy court. Second, Judge Kaplan had already decided this very issue in the previous Congoleum bankruptcy, and he said as much. Third, we were
the second bankruptcy,
correct?
Right?
In the second bankruptcy.
Okay.
Second, third, we were completely transparent with Judge Arleo. We filed a stipulation on the docket in the Occidental case that said we're going to resolve this through the bankruptcy, and then we got permission from Judge Vetri, who was the magistrate for Judge Arleo, to proceed before Judge Kaplan. So, and then finally, it's just a flat misstatement by counsel. We did not go to Judge Kaplan the second time. We went to Judge Ferguson. This is at A1816 to 1817, and she referred it to Judge Kaplan. So in terms of abuse of discretion, there was no abuse of discretion here. Second, it is not the case that this court's prior cases all deal with coercive orders. You think of a case like Lazy Days, which was the question was whether a lease was assignable. It is not the case that these are all coercive orders. Third, there's a lot of talk about what happened at the hearing. It is absolutely clear that this was not an agreement between Congolian and
which hearing?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, thank you for bringing me back. At the century approval hearing, this is at A1020. It is absolutely clear that this was not just an agreement between Congolian and BIW. The excess insurers were complaining precisely because it was getting rid of the rights of BIW for third-party claims. In fact, the excess insurers said, and this is at 1021 to 1023, we would have no problem if this were just an agreement between Congolian and Century. The problem is it purports to bind everyone. And so, Judge Fuentes, you're exactly right. This broad finding, right, this context is absolutely critical. Remember, BIW is giving up not just its rights against Congolian, its absolute right to exercise these insurance policies against claims by companies like Occidental. And so the idea that BIW gave all of this up just so it could protect itself against Congolian is preposterous. And indeed, the idea that adequate protection wasn't at issue, again, I just urge the court to read through this hearing. It starts at A1020. You will see, A, that CERCLA was front and center. They were talking about environmental claims by third parties. That B, it was not just a bilateral agreement between Congolian and Century. It was about, the whole thing was about other parties. And third, Judge Fuentes, you're absolutely right. The whole question was the reason they got adequate protection for BWI, the reason BIW could give up these policies is that it had a finding that protected it from liability.
So BIW has no responsibility for the liability.
That's right, Your Honor. We're a company up in Maine that builds ships, right? We're not having anything to do with the Passaic River, right? It's a horrible mess right now. It's being cleaned up. We're glad it's being done. We shouldn't have to pay for it. But regardless of whether you agree with that, that was the finding, and that can't be attacked now. Two quick more points, Your Honor. First, collateral estoppel. Of course, it's always open to the second court to decide the collateral estoppel issue. The whole point with all of these cases, like Lazy Days and Travelers, they could have decided in the Travelers case. They could have just had the asbestos cases decided. But the point is, the best position court to interpret the court's order is that court.
Travelers wasn't a 350B case, right? Just so I'm recollecting.
No, Your Honor, but it isn't, but it's post-confirmation, and that really is the key. And I'd just like to close with some of the questions Your Honor is worried about. There can never be impact on the state once the plan is confirmed and the case is closed because the confirmation ends the estate under 1141B. The court recognized this in Resorts International when it had the conceivable impact, when it said the conceivable impact test no longer applies. That test post-confirmation is impact on the plan. And here the plan, the confirmation order, is impacted if you can't enforce the confirmation order. That's what Resorts International said. It said that the interpretation of the confirmation order is related at least, and Esther Steele says actually it's more than just related, it's at the core.
Suppose the district court denied a motion to dismiss on this same issue.
Judge Arleo.
Any of the court, but sure. Could you then go and under 350B ask the bankruptcy court to reopen it to decide the same issue? Or would it be too late at that point?
So that would go into the it's a discretionary judgment, and that might go into.
So they're just saying it's possible that the bankruptcy court could still exercise 350B power to decide a question that the Article III court had already decided and reach a different decision?
So, Your Honor, I guess what I'm saying is, candidly, to bring it to this case, is when we had permission from Judge Arleo through her magistrate, I think it's clear Judge Arleo would not have decided what Judge Vetri decided, but the question is, was it an abuse of discretion for Judge Kaplan, before Judge Arleo had decided anything, having gone to the magistrate and said, please let us resolve this before Judge Kaplan, who, by the way, has already resolved and thought about these issues, and Judge Vetri said, yes, I am not letting Occidental file their summary judgment motion because it's clear that what Judge Kaplan is going to say will have an impact on that. The question before this court is that an abuse of discretion by Judge Kaplan? I think the answer to that is crystal clear. If the court has no further questions, the government asks to affirm the bankruptcy court and reverse the district court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We will take this case under advisement. Thank counsel for their excellent briefing and arguments. And